Thank you very much, Jonathan, and thank you once again to Schwartzensky Feldman for providing both space and lunch. Is the red light blinking on this camera? The red light is blinking. Okay, so that means that it's on.
It's working, yeah.
Okay, good, thanks. I'm going to pass around the sign-in sheet. Please make sure that you do sign in. This way you'll get notices of future webinars here, and if anything comes up during the class that I want to follow up on, I'll be able to do so. I'll pass it around going this way. There are two pages, so hopefully that's enough. Topic is Kalua versus Kafua. Is trademark infringement kosher? So, yeah, I received this article. I don't remember who it was who sent this to me. The truth of the matter is, while I heard people refer to Kahlua, I didn't actually know what it was. And so I figured the first thing is I need to know what Kahlua is. And so I brought it here on the sheet. If anybody else is in a position of not exactly knowing what this is, you can see here, courtesy of Wikipedia, Kahlua is a coffee-flavored, sugar-based liqueur from Mexico. The drink also contains rum, corn syrup, and vanilla bean. It is, in other words, a specific drink produced by a company. The company that produces it is owned by Absolut. And it is not kosher certified, just to make sure people are aware of that. But the point is, it's not a generic drink. In other words, it's not vodka, which, you know, different companies can produce and call vodka. It is actually somebody's product in the same way that, you know, Coca-Cola or any of the others that are here are produced by a particular company. Well, if you take a look at source number two, you find the problem. There's a company called Happy Hearts Winery based in New York, which is described usually as an importer of wines, but apparently they're also producing. And they're producing a liqueur, which you can see the label right beside the Kahlua label under Exhibit A. It is called Kafua. It is kosher. It is described on the label as coffee espresso liqueur. I'm not sure what espresso is. I gather that's part of the game. Well, except that it's the espresso, right? I assume it's part of the game that they're playing. But you can't see color on the black and white copy, but it's the same color scheme. In other words, it's a yellow background on both, and it's the same color of kind of an orangish red on the logo. Does anyone not have a sheet? There are more sheets here. We can pass them down. Pass down a few, please, so we'll have for this side. Not everyone has. Thank you. So, you know, just looking at it, looking at the Kahlua versus Kafua label, and assuming the bottles have the same coloring as well, what would you conclude as a consumer if you saw these? Sorry?
They're not ripping it off.
Well, we're beginning.
China's in the market.
Right. R-O-L-E-K-S. Would you, seeing this, assume that, A, it's, you know, a ripoff where some other company is manufacturing something trying to imitate the Kahlua, might you assume that it is actually from the same company? In other words, if they're using the same logo, more or less, maybe this is from the makers of Kahlua. We're now bringing you, for some reason, another drink called Kafua. And that, I think, is another legitimate possible explanation of it. Why would they do this? What's the goal of Happy Hearts Winery?
I mean, to capitalize on the dollar spent by Kahlua to make their product very well known and consumer friendly, and people think that it's a well known brand. It was good. It's been going for a long time. And you're capitalizing on their...
So you're effectively trading on their reputation.
Right.
In other words, they're hoping that the consumer is going to see it, think, this is from the makers of Kahlua, I guess I'll try this also.
Mm-hmm. Right.
That's one possible explanation. What would be another possible explanation?
Okay. Try to steal their business.
In what way?
Those who might otherwise buy Kahlua are now going to be enticed to buy Kahlua because it looks the same, maybe tastes the same, it's probably cheaper.
So in other words, they're not going to fool somebody into thinking it's from the makers of Kahlua, but they're going to present it as an alternative, and look, it's just like that. Even the label is the same. There's also the possibility that they're simply trying to create that which happened to me, and I'm sure happens to people all the time, happened to me, not in terms of Kahlua Kahlua, but in terms of Coca-Cola. Many years ago, I had moved to New England, to Rhode Island, and I went into a Shaw supermarket, and I wanted to buy a case of Coke, and, you know, reached down to the shelf and grabbed it and left the store, and only afterwards realized it was Shaw's Cola. And it was exactly, it was the coloring, it was the font, everything looked the same as far as someone who's not, you know, who's just rushing through the store trying to leave. So maybe you have somebody who's standing there in the liquor aisle, right, and is reaching out thinking he's getting Kahlua, and in fact it's Kahlua because he wasn't paying such close attention. So there's sort of a third possible logic behind what they're doing. The logic could be training on the goodwill. The logic could be presenting this as an alternative, and the logic could be simply to take advantage of people.
I mean, put it this way: would have called it kosher coffee liqueur, they got the same cells as they would have got as if they called it coffee.
Right, for sure not.
And the same shape, the bottle, the same.
Right,
and it might be cheaper.
Yeah,
the kafura.
Right,
and so they'd be looking at that.
It appears as if the kosher designation isn't bearing on the.
Yeah, I noticed that also. It must be on the back label. It must be on the back label. But yes, I looked for that also and saw that that wasn't there. It's worth noting that there's another possibility behind this, right? Another possibility is simply that it's shtick. It's something that they're doing just to be cute. In the Jewish world, and I think you find it among other ethnicities as well, you'll find that they'll take a certain name brand for something, give it sort of a Yiddishization, and pitch it. If you think of like Schlockrock, right, where they produce music and they'll take a known song, a popular song, and they'll give it Jewish lyrics and then put it out there. So I imagine that some of the companies that do that don't get permission for use of the tune, use of the music from those who are manufacturing it, and they fly below the radar because they're not making real money, they're not really fooling anybody, and therefore it's okay. Absolute happens to have a history of going after people recently for this sort of thing. This is not the first one. So, it's possible that they simply thought, we're going to fly below the radar, we'll be an ethnic kind of nuanced thing, and we'll call it Kahlua, and it'll be cute, and it'll be a marketing ploy, and no one's ever going to notice, and they got reeled in by the lawyers for Absolute. If you take a look at source number 3, an article from The Spirits Business, and there are similar articles you can find on various websites that are devoted to following the industry. Absolute argues that Happy Hearts has ignored its multiple cease and desist letters and has therefore filed an official complaint with the U.S. District Court for the Eastern District of New York, asking for an immediate preliminary injunction. The lawsuit accuses the Kahlua brand of dilution, infringement, and unfair competition, as well as trademark counterfeiting. Quote, there can be no credible argument that defendant's copying was not intended to capitalize on the fame and equity of the Kahlua brand and to trick consumers into purchasing defendant's inferior competing product, the company said in its injunction request. There was another quote that I saw in a different article where they said something along the lines of, come on, you can't possibly argue this any other way. This is obviously an imitation meant to capitalize on the Kahlua reputation. So they identify here four different concerns: dilution, infringement, unfair competition, and trademark counterfeiting. So what I want to do is take you through Canadian law and Jewish law in terms of how we would look at each of these points.
Can I say that maybe the Kahlua people are really another branch of the Kahlua people, and so they have sort of a cheaper brand.
Right.
They have an expensive brand, the Kahlua, and then they have a cheaper brand. So they're capitalizing on Kahlua. Meanwhile, it's the same people who are making it, and so they have two.
No, that's what a consumer might have thought, you're saying.
Yes.
Okay.
That's what I might have thought.
I hear. I think usually when companies do that sort of thing, they try to give them different identities. You know. Yeah. Or, I think, what was the one that Infinity was produced by whom? Right, so yeah, they presented it as a completely different brand. They didn't want people to look at them as associated.
All capitalizing.
Yeah. I mean, you have your luxury version, and then you have your...
Lexus does the same.
Right. Lexus is another example. So in terms of the issues here, what I'm going to look at are three issues, really. One, trademark infringement, in the sense that you're taking advantage of their work. They created an attractive label and built up a reputation for it, and you're taking advantage of what they've done. Number two, trademark dilution, where you are going to potentially dilute the good reputation that they have built up, as now it's going to be associated in people's minds with Kafua, which they may not like, which may in fact be an inferior product. And number three, the issue of passing off, which is deceiving the consumer. You're marketing this as though it's Kahlua or some relative of Kahlua, and in fact it's not. What I'm not going to deal with are two things. Number one, the question within Jewish law of whether the government is entitled to create certain protections for business like trademark protection and so on. I don't want to get into the Dina de Malchus law of the land debate, not because it's uninteresting, but because it'll take us far afield and we'll deal with the trademark issues. So I'm going to pretend that what we're doing is addressing this under Jewish law. In other words, forget the issue of what the government has said. We'll look at that separately and say, okay, so what would Jewish law present on this?
Could you also look at it from another perspective? Neighbor knows it's English.
Well, that's under the passing off discussion, yes.
But there's something of a skewed tool, right? You've got two people in one, two tradesmen in one quarter.
Correct.
So that's, that one, that's Jewish law.
Right, and that's going to come into this also. You'll see, that'll be under the infringement discussion. The other issue I don't want to deal with is, and just that just is very subjective, is the question of assessing how likely it is that people are going to be confused. Because that's a very subjective point, and it's open to its own discussion. Jeffrey was kind enough to send me a file from another lawsuit. This was Kellogg's sued Esso, because Kellogg's has Tony the Tiger, and Esso has the Esso Tiger. And the argument was that that would create confusion, and so there, the pages and pages of discussion in the Canadian suit of whether you can admit evidence from the fact that the two trademarks coexist in other countries and there's no confusion there. And how do you determine confusion? Does two cases constitute confusion? And so I don't want to... it's an interesting question in its own right. Looking at this, would the consumer be expected to be able to tell the difference or not? That's a good discussion in its own right. Okay. So we start with the question of trademark infringement. Taking advantage of his work, of the company's work, in designing an attractive label and building a reputation. If you take a look at source number four, this is from Canada's Trademarks Act, section 20. The right of the owner of a registered trademark to its exclusive use is deemed to be infringed by any person who is not entitled to its use under this act and who sells, distributes, or advertises any goods or services in association with a confusing trademark or trade name. So in other words, I have a registered trademark. The question of whether you have to register or don't have to register is also an interesting question in its own right. But right now we're discussing a registered trademark. And somebody else who is not entitled to use it, based on the terms of my registration, markets their goods or services with a trademark that can be confused with mine. That's your law against trademark infringement. So within Jewish law, the answer is it is actionable in a Jewish court. And we'll see how it works based on the following case, source number five. Source number five is a case which is known in yeshiva always by the shorthand makif v'nikaf. Makif is somebody who surrounds somebody else. Nikaf is somebody who is surrounded. And those are the names of the parties in this. It can also be a completely separate discussion in Jewish law. There, makif v'nikaf can mean something else, but that's what it means for our discussion. Imagine the following scenario. You have somebody who has property, let's say where the camera is located right here. And then you have somebody else who owns the fields that surround the property. Okay, he gets access to his property through a path, whatever it is, doesn't matter. But party A owns the middle, party B has the land around it. Party B says, you know, I need to fence in my fields, because otherwise people are going to walk through, they can see what's going on, I don't like that, I want the privacy, whatever the reason is. Party B says, I want to fence in my fields. Now, by fencing in his fields, he's also going to fence in Party A. So Party A is going to benefit from the fields, that from the fences that have now been put up, because it's also going to keep trespassers out of his field. Case is clear? So the question is, when Party B puts up those fences, can he claim payment from Party A? Can he say, you benefited from what I laid out to fence in your property, you should now have to pay me for it? What do you think?
Well, that has to be arranged. It has to be negotiated.
So one way to look at it is, you have to negotiate it in advance. You have to go to him and say, I'm going to build a fence. I would like you to pay in for it also. And he can say yes, he can say no. Right? That's one way to look at it.
Say no.
Sorry? So Chaim introduces the concept, which we're going to have to talk about, of zenene vezelo chaser, which means where two people benefit from something, and the benefit of B is not going to come at a loss to A, and A is the one who paid for it. So let's say I had a cottage, and somebody decides he's going to live in the yard when I'm not in the cottage. He puts out a sleeping bag and he's going to start living in the yard of my cottage. I come to him and say, I don't want you in my yard. And he says, I'm not hurting you. I didn't take anything. I clean up after myself. You don't rent it out. It's not like I'm taking advantage rent free. So let me live there. His argument is, I'm benefiting, but you're not losing anything. Don't charge me for it. So we're going to have to talk about that. And maybe that's the way to look at it in terms of the fencing. Because the fellow who has all the surrounding fields is benefiting from the work that he did, and the fact that the person in the middle is also benefiting doesn't hurt him. And so that's the way that you could look at it.
It might hurt him because now you're preventing access, to his fields because of the fence around the outer field.
Right, so no one in this case actually looks at it as harm to the individual in the inside. The assumption is whatever access he had before, whatever path or whatever, remains open. Yeah, no easement has been removed. He's good. So look at what the Talmud here says in source number 5. It's a Mishnah in the volume called Baba Batra, which deals, among its topics, it deals with zoning laws and issues of neighborly conduct. Hamaki v'schaveru mishalosh ruchosav. You have one party who surrounds another one on three sides. He actually surrounds him we'll say he surrounds him on only three sides for now. That's its own discussion, but it could be read a different way. It won't matter for us. He surrounds the inner guy on three sides. And he fences in the first side, the second side, and the third side without any arrangement, without any consultation. He didn't ask him to pay in. So we're not going to obligate the person living on the inside to contribute. Right? There's no reason to. The arrangement wasn't made. So he's good. However, Rabbi Yossi Omer, Amad v'gadar es haravias, if the guy on the inside then spends on fencing in the fourth side, then he says, Megalgalin al besakol, we are going to make him pay for all of the fencing. Not all the fencing in the sense they have to pay every dollar of it, but he has to pay a share towards everything. You follow? Because he fenced in the fourth, he's going to have to now pay for part of 1, 2, and 3. Why is that?
He made it clear that he benefits from the entire fence.
Right. So that's one approach. If you take a look at source number 6, the commentary of Tosfot on that passage from the Talmud, he says, V'im Tomer, you might ask, Ve'eze nene v'zelo chaser patur. He says, we have a general rule which says that one who is benefiting without harming the other is exempt from having to pay. So therefore, apilo amad nikaf nami, even if he says, you know what, I'm going to fence in the fourth side, he's not harming anybody by benefiting from the first three. V'yesh lomar, so his answer is, sha'ani amad nikaf. It's different where the person who is in the middle then stands up and says, I'm doing the fourth. He takes the initiative. D'gali adayte d'necha le behotza, because he has demonstrated that he's happy with that expenditure. He's happy to spend for fences. It's not the same thing as the case I gave of living in the guy's yard. Because in the case where he's living in the guy's yard, he just demonstrated that he wants to live there for free. He didn't demonstrate any willingness to spend. In this case, he has now shown he's fully willing to spend on a fence. So therefore, we're going to say, you're a partner to the guy who fenced in the other three sides, and you are going to have to pay. That's his statement. Clear? In truth, I'm not entirely comfortable with that, because I think you could make the argument that the guy is only demonstrating that he's happy to spend on a fourth wall where there are three other ones, not necessarily that he's happy to spend on all four. Yeah.
And could also be a situation that he was fine without any walls, but now he feels because there are three walls that he's in a disadvantageous position that forces him to build the fourth wall.
Why?
No, there could be a situation like that, I mean. I know people will be entering through the fourth side always and damaging a plantation he might have there or something.
I don't know. I mean, I would think that no one really wants to enter at that point from the fourth side because they can't go out the other side.
Well, they can go out the same side.
But then why would they go in unless they're there for his... I'm not sure I would see it. But in general, I think Tosa's point is not ironclad. But I bring this rule. Yeah.
I was going to ask, does morality enter into this? Take the guy that puts up the fourth wall. If the first three wouldn't have gone up, he probably wouldn't have put in the fourth wall because it would have served no purpose. Mm-hmm. These sides are open.
Right.
But by putting up the fourth one, there's now an enclosure, and he definitely benefits from the first three, which to me implies a moral obligation to make a contribution.
Right. So moral obligations are funny in the sense that they're real, but they don't necessarily translate into having to pay. Where that will matter is sort of the next phase after this, which is, can you stop somebody proactively from benefiting from your work? As opposed to saying, I want you to pay for your benefit. You say, no, you're not allowed to. And that's where the morality will come into it more. But applying this to our discussion now, I refer you back to a ruling by Rabbi Malkiel Tannenbaum, the Divrei Malkiel. I brought it for you on source number 7. I brought you a line from it. He dealt with a very interesting case. In his day, and you're talking 19th century Poland, they were already drinking bottled water. People think of bottled water as a modern phenomenon. There was a fellow who had purchased a license from the government to be able to market bottled water. And everything was government controlled, so you had to have a government license in order to be able to do it. So this fellow, you know, we'll call him Poland Spring. The Poland Spring is marketing water. They claim it's sweeter, it's better for you, whatever it is. And somebody else in another town says, I'm going to start marketing water. But I need the license in order to do it. So I'm going to put the label on my water. It's going to say Poland Spring. I'll reproduce his name and his label on my water. And the case comes to Rabbi Malkiel Tannenbaum for a ruling. Is there indeed, is there any prohibition against him doing so? It was very funny because he uses a word here, which I sat there scratching my head. What does that word mean until it hit me? The word etiketten. Couldn't figure out what in the world that was.
Etiquette,
mm-hmm. As in protocol. And I look up the etymology for the word etiquette, and lo and behold, it's actually from Old French, and it's the origin of the word ticket. So etiquette, as it says here, are tickets. And that's what he has printed up. It's his license from the government. Yeah.
But also, in Spanish, etiqueta means label.
Label. Okay, perfect. So, yeah, they're all working from the same root in terms of the European languages. Yeah. Okay. So take a look at source number 7, where he says the following. He says, Yesh Lomar, you could say, Dehu Adin Benidon Nidon, after quoting the case that I just mentioned to you about the fellow who's surrounding somebody else, he says, the same thing could apply in our case. Dekeman Shemad Pisa Etiketin Kemoshel Ploni, since he prints tickets that are just like this other fellow's tickets, Harei Chazinan Denechalo Bahotzaah. You see that he's happy with that expenditure, meaning the expenditure in his case of getting the license from the government. And so he has to pay part of the money spent by the first party in order to get the license, and he views it as though they have developed a partnership. And the key is demonstration of intent. And so is ruled, I brought in source, no, sorry, it is a different source, but so is ruled in the Shulchan Aruch Hoshin Mishpat Reish Samach Dalet, that demonstration of intent is in fact the key. It shows what you wanted. So therefore, based on this, we would say that the folks who manufacture kafua are going to have to pay for the investment of the kalua makers in developing this label. Yes?
I find this is all very unilateral in the sense that by breaching etiquette, you are now entitled to become partners. Mm-hmm. So in other words, if I go out tomorrow and make a car called, I don't know, Lexus, mm-hmm. now Lexus is somehow obliged to become my partner. It seems to be unilateral coming from the wrong side of the equation. I also found it interesting that there's no comment that the Polish government is policing the distribution of licenses.
Right. So in terms of the first point, we're going to get to that. In other words, the ability of the original producer to say, no, I don't want you as a partner, get out of the business, is coming. That we'll get to. Right now we're just dealing with paying damages, so to speak. It's not really damages, but what he's going to have to pay for what he has already done. In terms of the Polish government, it's true. You don't find any discussion in the responsum of what the government has to say or anything like that. I think largely because when you're dealing with 19th century Poland, the idea of turning this guy in to the Polish government for whatever punishment they're going to levy is anathema. Yeah, the government itself would not have been good, frankly, at policing this.
Well, I just assume they would shoot everyone and start over. But other than that, I guess they'll get to it. You know, you're talking about reimbursement of expenditures, but there's no discussion of forfeiture of profits.
Correct. Correct. There doesn't seem to be. It sounds like we're viewing it as a partnership. And I think one reason for that is actually because what we're dealing with is so vague. In other words, we, sitting here looking at the two labels, asked ourselves, what is the consumer thinking? And came up with three reasonable things as to what's going to cause the consumer to take the bait, so to speak. It's hard to define that. How much of a purchase was actually because of this? In addition to which, you have a separate question, which is, in Jewish law, generally speaking, when you're dealing with paying for financial harm, we have a principle of grumma. And grumma means that even if I harm somebody else, if the harm was indirect, then he can't claim damages from me. In other words, I wasn't supposed to do it, but he can't claim damages if the harm is indirect. And there's a lot of discussion about what constitutes indirect, but I think this would certainly qualify as indirect. So I don't think you're going to get damages out of this. And I think, frankly, it's a little bit creative that we're saying that you're going to be able to claim, payment for whatever you paid the graphic designer to come up with this label and to produce these the labels. But let's see where we're going to go with this, because the point of the unilateral partnership is going to be addressed. The next piece, though, that before I get to the unilateral damages, the unilateral partnership, is one piece that Jonathan mentioned before, which is intellectual property. The design. Paying for a design, it's not like paying for a license. Paying for a license, you got permission to do it based on your fee that you pay the government. But here, it's just a design. It's intellectual property. Is that even considered to be something of substance? The truth of the matter is that in secular law, it's fairly recent that you have a concept of intellectual property at all. If I were doing this entire session on intellectual property, which we could do sometime, I would give you more of the history of the Statute of Anne and so on. But really, it's the last few hundred years that any sort of protection exists for the producer of intellectual property. And generally speaking, the reason for it is not because I view intellectual property as real property. It's more because we think that society needs to protect creators of things. Because if you don't, no one will create things. We need to create an incentive and a protection for people who are going to create. That's really what drives intellectual property law in great measure. there's more to discuss on it, but that's a basic statement. So what about within Jewish law? And the answer is that we do have protection for intellectual property, but it's also very difficult. And the first major case in which it comes up is in the 16th century. And again, this is also a case that we could spend a lot of time on. If we do intellectual property at some session, we'll talk about it in greater length. But basically, there was a great publishing war that went on in the 16th century regarding publishing the works of Maimonides. Maimonides wrote a work of law called Mishneh Torah. In the 16th century in Venice, Jews were not allowed to publish books. They were not allowed to control printing houses. And instead, Christians were the owners of the printing houses, but they saw an advantage in publishing for this niche community. It was a very literate community. They wanted books. And so what they did was, they hired Jews to work for them to put out Jewish books. Well, there was a Rabbi Meir of Padua who had printed an edition of Maimonides' Mishneh Torah with his own commentary under one publisher. There was a competing publisher who took that work and copied it, added a bit here and there, including the commentary of Rabbi Meir of Padua, and printed it and sold it more cheaply. And he even, to add insult to injury, on the front page, put in this whole explanation of what he has done with this work, and he says, I've included this commentary by Rabbi Meir of Padua just because people say they want it there for completeness, but the truth is scholars say it's inferior and terrible anyway. It was a remarkable scandal in 16th century Venice. So the fight over this publication is taken to Rabbi Moshe Isserles. Rabbi Moshe Isserles, at the time, was fairly young, but he was the rabbi of Krakow. He would ultimately write the Ashkenazi portion of the Code of Jewish Law. And he dealt with this issue, and he ruled mostly in favor of Rabbi Meir of Padua to protect the rights of the producer. Not fully, but in large measure. And he presented several reasons for his position, including what you see in source number 8. He says there, actually, source number 8, the truth is I didn't bring the substantive part. I see all that I wrote there was his general statement before he presents his four reasons, in which he says, absolutely, you should not purchase these volumes of the new edition of Maimonides' work of Mishneh Torah. But one of the reasons that he presents is source number 9, and it's the issue of unfair competition. Source number 9 is a source I think we actually referred to at some point in another session. Source number 9 is dealing with a case in the Talmud in Bava Batra. It comes from Rabbi Mordechai ben Hillel, as you can see on the sheet, an Ashkenazi commentator to the Talmud, in which he writes, Mavui hasasu mishloshat stadin. Rak b'tzad echad upasuach lichnos bo. If you imagine that you have a street that opens off of the main thoroughfare, and this street is closed in on three sides. The only way in, the only way out, is through the main road. V'dar Reuven eats el sofo asasum. And Reuven lives at the closed end. So if you imagine that out in the lobby there is the main thoroughfare, and here is the street. So you have Reuven, who lives somewhere down at that end. And then, Uba Shimon ladur keneget sada pasuach. Shimon comes in, and he's going to live right here. So Shimon is here, Reuven is in there. And the idea is that Reuven owns a business at that end, and Shimon is going to open up a competing business, but at this end, such that people are not going to be able to enter unless they cross Shimon's path. They have to pass Shimon's business, and therefore they're likely to go there first. So the rule is that Reuven is able to prevent him from doing so. That is called unfair competition. That's one of the arguments that Rabbi Isserles brings on the case of Rabbi Meir of Padua. In other words, you can't argue theft is the key. The fact that he's using your intellectual property, you can't say to him, you used my property, it's not a physical thing, they just copied something. But you can argue that it's unfair competition. And that can be applied to our discussion here in terms of trademark infringement. If you take a look at source number 10, Rabbi Yaakov Yeshaya Blau, author of the work Pitchei Choshen, applies the same to our discussion about product labels. He says...
So why is competition that nature?
Sorry?
Why is competition of that nature Islam?
Right. Why is there a prohibition against this kind of harsh or unfair competition? So this goes back a little bit to the discussion we had about OPEC several months back. The license that we have to compete is bounded by certain principles. In other words, it's not an open capitalist system in which we say, let everybody do their best and whoever wins, wins. One of the principles is that competition has to be positive. In other words, I can't compete in such a way that is geared just towards undermining somebody else and driving him out of business. It has to be motivated by profit. That's one principle. But another principle is that you can't do that which the Talmud is calls yored l'umnuso shel chavero, descending into somebody else's livelihood, meaning that you're not allowed to run somebody else. You're not allowed to ruin somebody else's livelihood. It's a basic. It's a basic principle that sort of justifies itself. In other words, I didn't steal anything. I didn't, light his factory on fire. Nothing like that. Nonetheless, that's actually going to be prohibited in its own right. It's inappropriate conduct towards this person. If you want to look for biblical links, in terms of where it comes from, so some will link it to the principle of Hasagas Gevul, where the Torah says you're not allowed to overstep the boundary of somebody else. You are overstepping his boundary. That's one possible basis for it. There's more to say about this. Maybe we'll have a longer class on that subject because it is an interesting topic. But what we're effectively arguing here is a second approach. In other words, we argued partnership. You become a partner in the expenditure. What we're arguing now is that what you engage in is unfair competition. It's really sort of because this is intellectual property. We're arguing that it's unfair competition. And that's what Rabbi Blau says in source number 10. He says, Nira shebizmanenu kayam musag shel monitin. It appears that today, nowadays, there's a concept of monitin. Monitin is actually used in modern Hebrew, but it goes all the way back to the Midrash. And it's a term that has its origins in Greek. And what it means is reputation.
Well, goodwill. In the account, it's basically goodwill.
Yeah. In Rome, the term for money or the mint was moneta, and it comes from the fact that their mints were also temples for the goddess Juno Moneta. I assume money is based in the same word, but that may go back to the Greek moneres or Latin monere, which refer to warning. So you're sort of broadcasting information. All of this courtesy of an article that appeared in the Israeli newspaper Haaretz. They had a word of the day column. August 25th, 2013. You can find it online. But in any case, that's what he's referring to. It is goodwill or reputation. He says, it seems that today there's a concept of reputation, goodwill, which is worth money. He says, a factory which acquires a good reputation adds to its assets. And upon a factory's sale, the purchaser will pay concretely for this, for the goodwill. Certainly, one may not use another's assets when the other one prohibits it, and we're going to talk about that. And certainly when it has been acquired via years of strain and hard work. He says, you don't have the right to take advantage of this person's goodwill. So really what we're seeing are two points. Point number one is you become a partner because you demonstrated that you would have been willing to invest in that kind of a label. And number two, it's unfair competition because you are using the goodwill that they built up. You're using the label that they designed. Separate from that, this was all under recovery of costs in terms of the cost you spend on the label. But that's not what you really want. What you really want is to be able to stop him from doing the competition. And this takes us out of the unilateral realm to say, can you stop him from doing so? And the answer is absolutely. You are able to stop him from doing so. He doesn't have the right to say, great, now we're partners because I produced a label that looks like yours. You can't do it. And that's taken as a given in the sources. And the question is, well, why? We already mentioned that if one party benefits and the other doesn't lose, you're assuming the other doesn't lose, then you can't stop him from doing what he's doing. And there is also a principle of midat sidon. And what that means is, if I am going to benefit by if I ask someone to do something for me. Except that he's not really cutting his nose off even. But spiting the face is what's going on. If I want someone to do something for me, it's not going to cost him anything at all. It won't cost him time. It won't cost him effort. It won't cost him money. He will not lose anything by doing this. And it will help me. Normally, the rule is we demand that he do it. If it's not going to cost him anything, so why not? So, for example, you have a bunch of brothers who inherit an estate. And one of the brothers happens to own land right next to the estate. So when they're going to divide up the land, he says, do me a favor, give me my portion as the one that abuts my field. And they're all equal in value, they're all of the same quality, there's no issue like that. So the court will say to the brothers, you have to do that. Because it doesn't cost you anything to give him the field that's going to be more convenient, now will be, beside his other fields. So the question here is, assuming you could argue that the Kalua people aren't losing anything by these people making the Kafua, assuming you can make that argument, would the Kalua makers be able to stop them from doing this with the Kafua? And the answer is yes. They can still stop them. And the reason they can stop them is brought in source number 11, which says, in brief, you're allowed to keep other people from living in your house. He's dealing with the case in which someone wants to live in my yard and say, well, you know, it isn't costing you anything. The answer is, it doesn't make a difference. It's my property. I am allowed to keep people out of my property if I wish, without having to give an explanation of how I am losing by having them there. And there are two different approaches to why I can do that. One approach brought by Rabbi Isserles in source number 12, I'm not going to read it inside just in the interests of time. Rabbi Isserles' point is because you could make money on it, even if you're choosing not to. You could be renting out your house, you could be selling the right to use this label. It's worth value. That's one reason. But the other reason, which I brought you in source number 13 from Rabbi Yosef Chaviva, the Nimuka Yosef, quoting Rabbi Aaron Halevi, the other argument is simply for any reason I like. It's my property. By definition, I get to use it however I choose. And even without, you know, loss of funds or any other concern, if we own this label, we have the right to decide who's going to use this label. And he doesn't have the right to say, well, I'm going to use it, I'm going to pay you for it. So, number one, initially I can demand that he not use it. And then number two, if he did use it before I found out, I'm able to demand some degree of payment, whether that's payment towards what it cost me to design the label. You know, what exactly he's going to have to pay, frankly, is less clear to me. It sounds like he'd have to pay towards the label, but that doesn't solve the reputation issue. So I'm not sure how you deal with that.
Well, the prophet, right, when you say that, at least from source 10,
yeah,
he's actually referring to the fact that there is a profit sharing. But he's saying, he basically said, upon the fact you sell, the purchaser will pay for the goodwill. Meaning he recognizes that
there is something, right.
There's a value there, which has to be compensated.
Right, so then you have to appraise it.
But you could include there all the advertisement to build the brand.
Oh boy, that's right. You can have to pay for the advertising. And that will go back however many years you've been doing it. This can end up being very costly for happy wines people, happy hearts.
In reality, some companies, some businesses, their biggest asset is the things on their balance sheet, which is their
right. Well. No, absolutely true. So this is all one piece. This is all trademark infringement. But then there's a second issue, which is trademark dilution. And the second and third issues are shorter than the first one. But the trademark dilution, if you take a look on the third side, from the Trademarks Act, no person shall use a trademark registered by another person in a manner that is likely to have the effect of depreciating the value of the goodwill attaching thereto. I can't use his label if that could weaken his fame, if it could weaken his goodwill. And there are two different reasons for this. One reason for it is brought in source number 15, Rabbi Blau in his Pitrei Choshen. He says this is the rule of Hasagas Gevul. You're overstepping his boundaries, unfair competition. For you to weaken his reputation by attaching his reputation to an inferior product, assuming it's an inferior product, is in and of itself unfair competition. That's not clean play. Clean play is you make your product look good. You provide incentives for your product, not you go out there making his product look bad. And that's something that you see actually in the law in terms of negative advertising and the like. So that's one reason. Another reason, though, is that you are actively harming his reputation. In other words, not just that ethically this is unfair competition, which is more of a moral claim, but you are effectively damaging something that has value. And just as we say that if you live in someone else's yard and you damage the yard, you're going to have to pay for it. And that's a passage out of the Talmud that that is ruled in source number 16. There's a requirement that I pay for my benefit from the yard. The same thing is going to be true over here. So if you look at source number 17, going back to Rabbi Malkiel Tannenbaum in his discussion about the case of the water salesman, he says there's no loss to the person who is selling the water first, because this fellow is in another town. You're not getting there. That may be true. Nonetheless, he says, in our case, selling this merchandise harms him. It harms the first person because, he says, if not for this person, the second one, the licensed party could sell more. First of all, he says, maybe you want to expand your business. Number two, he says further, he harms him by enlarging his business in the eyes of the world, subjecting him to more taxes and the like, meaning you're putting the original guy's name on the label. Right? The government could legitimately come to him and say, you're operating now in multiple towns, you're doing bigger business, we're going to tax you more. That's a separate concern, which we didn't even get into in our case. But also, sometimes the merchandise he produces is going to be inferior, and therefore you are going to now cause people to think of his merchandise as inferior merchandise. So therefore, diluting his good reputation is a legitimate second concern in a Jewish court. So we have two concerns. Number one, trademark infringement. Number two, trademark dilution. And those are from the perspective of the relationship between the Kafua people and the Kalua people. So the Kalua people can go to them and say, we're upset on two grounds. But then there's also the last concern. And the last concern is deceiving the consumer and the rule of passing off. If you take a look at source number 18 from the Trademarks Act, no person shall direct public attention to his goods, services, or business in such a way as to cause or be likely to cause confusion in Canada at the time he commenced so to direct attention to them between his goods, services, or business and the goods, services, or business of another. You can't market something in such a way that it will cause confusion as to whether it's your item or what somebody else sells. That's the simple sort of English version of source number 18. So So that's exactly right. The principle that we have is what's called genevas das, literally stealing one's mind or stealing one's point of view, and it's a function of not misleading people. There is a prohibition in general in Jewish law against misleading other people, and particularly when it comes to goodwill. If you take a look at source number 19, we are told you're not allowed to push somebody else to dine with you. You keep inviting somebody to a meal. You know he's not going to say yes. But you figure, if I invite him like this over and over again, he's going to think I'm a wonderful guy, that I'm very magnanimous, and I keep on inviting him. Or offering somebody a great gift, knowing full well that he's not going to accept. So you're taking advantage of him and causing him to think something that's not true. And the Talmud has many such examples of this. So if I'm not allowed to take advantage of undeserved goodwill, and I'm even supposed to take steps not to do things that will cause people to think something, something that is incorrect, so then certainly I can't go out and intentionally mislead people. Now they may argue our quality really is the same as theirs, and therefore someone isn't misled. But that's most subjective. And if the customer would disagree, then their claim doesn't matter. It's from the point of view of the customer. So without a doubt, the business is not entitled to market itself in such a way that it's going to fool people. But that leads to one last question, and then I'll summarize. And that's the question of, so is the sale reversible? In other words, I bought the kafua. I go back to the store and I say, I thought I was getting Kahlua, and in fact, I got Kafua. Can you demand a refund on that basis? What would you say?
No.
No? Why not?
You look carefully. Let the buyer beware.
Yeah,
right? Buyer beware. Even though it's misleading.
And meant to be misleading.
Even in secular law, you'd be able to kill the sale.
So you would or not? You would be able to kill the sale. So let me ask the question a little bit differently, because the truth is that the way I'm posing it with a store, it actually I interposed a third party, and that's the store owner. Mm-hmm. And that introduces all sorts of questions. Did the store owner put them side by side? You know, how exactly was the placement done? That's its own question. So let me not present it that way, but instead say the kafua manufacturer is out there, and he has kalua, and he has kafua. So he's putting them out to you. Are you able to say, I bought kafua thinking that it was kalua, I'd like to return this?
And it's your fault.
Yeah, and it's your fault. It's the owner's fault. He's selling both of them together.
Doesn't sound much different than the old North American label, that sensation. Instead of saying basa kosher, he's saying basa basa. He's taking the bait for a half.
Yeah.
So it sounds like it is deliberate misrepresentation. The problem is, how do you know whether a little nuance between two products is there in order to misrepresent, or is it just that both of them had a similar creative, both designers of each product had similar ideas?
Are those being sold at the same cost? Are you saying to Europe, this is Kalua, this is Kapura, this is like 10, much less, or 50 percent, I'll take this, it tastes exactly the same. And then you taste it, and it doesn't. So
right.
It really depends on
right. So a couple of things in terms of what you, you know, in terms of Gershon's point that the you know, how do you know what was the intent? I think in this case, as was stated in the you know, in the original filing by Absolute, I think you know exactly what the, you know, whether the intent was to fool people or whether the intent was to send them a message that they're equal or whatever it was. There's no question that they were imitating the first, and they knew they were imitating the first. And then whatever they intended beyond that doesn't really matter, because it's the impact on the consumer. In terms of the question of what if you tell them something, you tell them it's just as good, then you for sure have a problem.
If you think about the whole generic industry that's out there today, which is exactly this, well, very similar to this concept of providing the public with something that's similar to a brand label. But if you notice, none of these generic players, the real ones, ever go anywhere near to confusing the you know, colors, whatever, but the naming by Kafua Kalua, there's only really one objective in that.
Yeah.
Whereas, you know, that's the raison d'etre, presence, choice, which has become a label in its own right. But there's, you know, you can either buy Oreos or you could buy, you know, two pieces of chocolate and vanilla. There's no, the
right.
Rules are fairly clear on that.
Right. I mean, if they start selling Opios, then they're going to have the same situation as what we're describing here. Right. I think there are certain lines that are supposed to be observed within the industry. Although, as I said, there are those who are going to find the Schwarz Cola example, where it's really the color, and they're not the only ones. It's just the one that happened to me.
I think the burden that's put on the consumer is not particularly high. In other words, if it's even remotely close, the benefit that goes to the consumer.
Yeah.
Halachically, does it make a difference if it goes to a specific group where the other product is not an option? Let's say if you said Kalua is not kosher, this one is kosher, and it's all like in kosher stores targeting the community that only eats kosher.
It's an interesting question. So,
the question is there such a thing as kosher or not kosher in Kalua? That's another issue.
No. Well, let's assume, without getting into any questions of why Kalua wouldn't be kosher, without even going there. Could it be argued that if you sold it in a store that is marketing specifically to kosher consumers, I mean, you can't keep anybody out of your store, so you know anybody can walk in. But the question of whether you could argue, I didn't hurt them, I didn't dilute their reputation because people here were going to buy from them anyway. Could they respond, well, you know, we had entertained thoughts of coming under certification at some point in the future? I don't know. I want to think about that one a little bit.
They still have trademark dilution.
Well, you wouldn't necessarily, because you're talking to people who never had the goodwill in the first place and would never be acting on any goodwill. If you confine what you're doing to this one group...
I don't think you can get away with it, because otherwise you could say the whole concept of stamina doesn't exist. Because if you could sell it in a store where only, how can I say, if you could drink it only in a place... where Shomrei Mitzvahs were in there all the time, then the whole concept would fall away.
Right.
In our Samyang. But the whole idea is...
I don't think so. It would take me too long to discuss why I don't think so. But I think the one point that you would have is, going back to what we said about trademark infringement, where we gave two different theories behind why you would be liable for it. One reason was the argument that it's unfair competition. So that doesn't exist here because they're not competing. The other argument, though, was you entered into a partnership by making use of that which they had invested in. And the truth of the matter is that the kosher consumer who goes into that store has seen the Kahlua label and knows it and trusts it because it has a good reputation. And so therefore, you are still... you are still trading on the work that they put into building that brand. So I think in that sense, you may still be responsible. You were going to say something?
I was just going to say that a little while ago, they came up with a thing called a lemon bomb. And a piece of lemon sat at the bottom, put the water in it, it was lovely. All of a sudden, there were all sorts of
coffee
imitations, much less. I bought one. It leaked. And, it seems to be part of the commerce. I mean, even the colors are the same.
Mm-hmm.
Shape, and then a few people, I guess to maybe avoid damages, modified the bottle by adding, another piece. Right? Which...
Well, that's the business of the Trademarks Act. That's where do we draw the line and say this is confusing or this is not confusing, or if something is patented, at what point do we say prior art exists? So, how do you work with that? That's another question. I'm going to just make sure to finish this point because it's going to get late. In terms of whether the sale is reversible, we distinguish between a couple of different points. Is it where you're saying, I want this refunded because it's not worth the price I paid? Or is it, I want this refunded because it's not the product I thought I was getting? If your argument is, it's not worth the price I paid, then the law of Onah kicks in. There's a prohibition recorded in the Talmud based on biblical text against selling something for more than a certain percentage over what it's worth. 1/6 more than what it's worth. If you sell it for less than that, if the difference is less than that, there's no claim. If the difference is more than that, then the sale is void. If the difference is the same, then the answer is that he just has to refund the profit. In other words, it's a little bit of a more complicated field. You have to demonstrate what it really was worth, and frankly, I don't know how you do that. If, on the other hand, it's because the item wasn't what I wanted, then it's very clearly reversible. If you take a look at source number 20, where the Mishnah teaches, Machar lo chitin yachos v'nimtzu raos, you sell him good wheat, turns out to be bad wheat. He's allowed to retract. The consumer is allowed to walk away. And the sages ask, well, why? Isn't that just a case of greater value, lesser value? And so, Rabbi Vidal of Toulouse, the Magen Mishnah, in source number 21, explains, here it's different. In the wheat market, good wheat and bad wheat are actually considered different products. It's not the same product worth more or worth less. They have different uses. They have different, they're handled differently. And so they're in fact viewed as different products. And in the case where he thought that he was going to get something else, he'll be able to reverse it. What's key is how can he prove what he wanted? In other words, it could be he comes back to the story and says, I really wanted Kahlua instead of Kapua, but he's lying. How do you know? So there the principle is what's called umdina. And umdina is an Aramaic term for estimating what was in his mind. And what you have to do, and a court would have to do in hearing this case, is figure out what do people normally think when they are standing there in the store. How likely is it? I gave you an example of this discussion in source number 22, one case of umdina. You have a fellow who thinks that his son has passed away. And he writes a will, or whatever it is, he just writes a document, it doesn't have to be a will. Will introduce other complications. He writes a document saying he's giving away all his property to somebody else. Then he finds out that his son is alive. So, as Rabbi Shimon ben Manasseh argues in source number 22, it's clear that he only did this because he thought he didn't have an heir anymore. Finding out his son is alive voids the gift that he had just made. And the same thing is going to be true regarding our discussion. If it's clear that he got fooled, then he's going to be able to argue for the reversal of the sale. So just to sum up what we've said, the first point is, in terms of trademark infringement, where you are taking advantage of somebody else's work, it is indeed actionable in a Jewish court. Whether in terms of a unilateral partnership, you just became partner with them, and therefore you have to pay for costs of developing a label, you have to pay for advertising perhaps, the how far we'll go, we have to pay for how we built up the goodwill, I tend to think not. The second point within it is that you would have to pay because it's unfair competition in terms of the intellectual property that you have now used for your own purposes. He would also be entitled to stop you from marketing this way because of the fact that you are using his property. In terms of diluting his good reputation, giving it now, cheapening his reputation, so that would be prohibited as well, either under unfair competition, unfair competition, overstepping the boundary, or alternatively, you are harming his reputation, and reputations have value, and therefore you're taking something that was worth more and making it worth less. And then finally, in terms of deceiving the consumer, that is clearly prohibited. And the consumer would be able to reverse the sale, either if he could prove it was worth much less than what he thought, although, again, especially nowadays where prices are so fluid and each store determines its own, unless it's a gas station, I think that I think it's hard to argue that it's worth less than what you paid. But in terms of saying it's not what I thought I was getting, if that's a logical, reasonable thing for someone to say that they meant to get X and they instead got Y, then you'd be able to claim and reverse the sale on that basis. Yes?
I was in the United States not long ago, and I found myself in a place with lovely kosher items, and this was a canned item, soup. It's not quite, we're not talking reputation, but it might be. And it had a wonderful picture on the outside of the can. With lots of meat and potatoes and carrots and vegetables. Olive gets us off and I thought, oh, this is a wonderful soup. I bring it home and it's dreadful. It's not that it doesn't taste good, but there's no meat to speak of. It's just a little tiny piece of something that might be meat. And
it was a serving suggestion on the label.
It looked dreadful.
Yeah.
So what did I do? I called the company because there's a phone number that says, call us if you're not happy.
Yeah.
Oh, I'm calling you. I'm not happy. I'm not happy. Okay. The picture looked wonderful.
Yeah.
I took it to mean that you are going to include in that can what I saw on the picture. Otherwise, you are fooling me.
So what did they say?
They said, you're right.
Did they give you compensation?
They sent you another one.
No. She gave me money back.
Yeah.
She gave me a fair bit more than I paid. She knows what I paid for it. Because it said, on the back it says all kinds of things, and she knew.
Interesting.
What it was. Yeah. And she gave me the money back. And she said, I will take it up with my people here. I don't know if that'll be, I don't care. But I wanted to make myself clear that this was fooling me. This was, what was it? False advertising,
So, interesting.
Did we talk about that at all?
Well, yeah, that was the whole passing off and source number. If you take a look at source number 19, number 20, yes, that's the issue.
Yeah. I have a question about this so-called.
If anyone has to go, it's fine. I won't be offended.
The 16th century scandal that you're alluding to. Was the author Jewish, and how was it resolved?
So, Rabbi Meir of Padua was Jewish. The publishers were not Jewish.
You mean a non-Jew wrote?
Non-Jews were publishing the Jewish book. Yeah.
No, but the commentary.
Yeah, it was Jewish. Rabbi Meir of Padua was Jewish.
Right, but the extra commentary.
No. What happened was Rabbi Meir of Padua was the writer of the commentary on Maimonides' work.
Right.
The second publisher, not Jewish, just like the first publisher, included various elements that Jews had contributed to it. They all worked with Jews working under them. And the way it ended up being resolved was that Rabbi Isserles ordered that no one could buy from the second one until the run produced by the first one would be sold. But if I remember correctly, he did not protect beyond that first run.
Okay.
That he did not do, if I remember correctly.
I was at his grave in Krakow. It's very visible.
Oh, yes. Okay.
Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.